From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Philadelphia, where a couple of guys were doing some planning around a kitchen table, Daniel Hunter and Jethro Hayko, and they didn't have much money. They knew they were going to be outspent by hundreds of millions of dollars, but they were determined not to allow big money to push a massive new casino on a city that didn't want or need it. They were worried about corruption. Their work became the subject of a book, and now Daniel Hunter is channeling his energy into helping other Americans learn how to organize more effectively. He has a new booklet out himself. That book is called Building a Movement to End the New Jim Crow. So Hunter is one of the featured speakers at Colgate-Rochester Crozer Divinity School's Spring Lecture Series next week. That series is titled When I Was in Prison, Restoring Dignity and Justice. It runs next Monday through next Thursday. They've got a number of events. This hour, we've got a chance to talk to several speakers about their work and their focus in Rochester next week. In studio, we have Dr. Marvin McMickle, who is a director of Black Church Studies and also just the president of Colgate-Rochester Crozer Divinity School. Dr. McMickle, always a pleasure to have
Thank
you.
Thank you. Nice to come back with you.
And Daniel Hunter is on the line with us. He is an organizer with Training for Change and author of Building a Movement and the New Jim Crow. Daniel, thanks for taking the time for the program.
Evan, thank you so much for having me on.
Dr. McMickle, let me just start with you, just sort of the brief overview. Your theme here is When I Was in Prison, and we've talked a lot about justice, about equality, about fairness. Why did you want this to be the focus of your spring lecture series?
Well, for two reasons. One, we have a rotating set of themes for our lecture series, but we also want to connect the issues of incarceration with the biblical text. And this phrase, when I was in prison, is taken right out of Matthew 25. So in a sense, we're saying to the faith community, you cannot be fully engaged as a member of the Christian tradition if you are not interested in, concerned about, and vocal around issues of incarceration in prisons. So it's for us, it's a pretty straightforward question.
And you see a landscape of inequality in the incarceration system.
All my life and before then. The opening movie we're going to be showing called The 13th, is about a history of that goes back to slavery and then works its way through the times of sort of post-Reconstruction and right on up to the present day. So, yeah, I think it's an untold story. Michelle Alexander's book has kind of pulled the cover back on it a little bit, but there's so much work that needs to be done and so much attention that must be raised around the issue of incarceration.
If you jump on the Colgate-Rochester Crozer Divinity School website, you can find the Spring Lecture Series events. Again, it starts next Monday, the 17th, runs through Thursday, the 20th, and we're going to be working through that schedule for you. But I want to talk to Daniel Hunter, who is part of those events. In fact, he is speaking on Wednesday night, that's the 19th, at 7 p.m., talking about building social movements in a time of polarization. And Daniel, if I could, I want to read a little bit of what Reverend James Lawson says in a foreword to your book. He says, quote, too much activism today is simply for the sake of activism and does not move public awareness. And he says that if activism is going to move our nation toward genuine equality and justice, we must deliberately employ the unimaginable power of nonviolent civil resistance. You agree with that, that too much activism today is just activism for its own sake?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to be critical of my fellow activists, but I think it's often the case that we are wanting so much to be in motion. We're wanting so much to do something that we're not spending the time that's necessary to address the question of what kind of action will be meaningful. And so part of the talk that I want to give is, in this particular political context, what is it that we need to be doing that's going to be not only meaningful for our individual selves, for our expression of our desire to do something in the face of injustice, but how do we do something that's meaningful? How do we do something that's involved in meaningful social change as opposed to just doing action for its own sake?
And I've been referring to Daniel's book. I think it's about 80 pages. So if I say book, is it a booklet, a book? It's kind of a guide, you know. What's the correct term?
Sure.
Here?
Guide is great. Organizing guide is a great term.
An organizing guide, which I think
we wrote it.
Oh, go ahead.
We wrote it in response to Dr. McMickle referenced Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. And it's a very illuminating book around the history of mass incarceration in this country. And it left a lot of people wondering, so what do I do about something? It's one thing to know that something is bad. And then the next question is, so what do I do about it? So the organizing guide was written as a brief sort of bringing people into the study of social change, as it were, and how is it that we organize and mobilize.
And that book, that organizing guide, Building a Movement to End the New Jim Crow, will be available at Daniel's event at Colgate next week, 7 p.m. Wednesday night. The book does several things for people who want to organize more effectively. First, it looks at historical roles played in movements, and then it looks at building strong groups. And then the step is to create change through effective campaigns. And Daniel, is that where activism breaks down most often? I mean, it's one thing to understand history, to educate yourself, and it's another to form groups, but another thing entirely to put together effective campaigns.
Yeah, I think one of the things that often happens is to be an effective campaign, to be an effective social change agent, is we can spend a lot of time looking, especially in this moment, looking nationally. What's the big thing? What is happening at sort of the national scale? And while movements are small and young, one of the things that we need to do is really build up local capacity. And one of the most effective things, and this is a big lesson from the civil rights movement, one of the most effective things that they did was they would design local campaigns. So that is, local campaigns have a specific goal, they have a specific target, and they're designed on how can a small group of people make a change. So you referenced our fight in Philadelphia, where we were fighting multi-million dollar casinos, and it was a campaign where we were trying to stop this bad thing from happening, and so we had a very clear goal. And that's in contrast as from if we had just gone into the streets and said, we don't want this thing to happen. But campaigning is the art of how do you organize over a period of time and escalate a series of actions and tactics over time in order to put pressure on a particular target in order to win what you want to win. And it's that art of escalation, taking a series of actions, as opposed to just let's go into the streets and hope that they'll be inspired by what our message is.
So,
and that's the big difference.
All right, so, and Daniel, we could spend a whole hour or a whole day talking about your success in Philadelphia, which is the subject of an entirely separate book that, you know, it's kind of this, as they say, David and Goliath kind of struggle that you were able to be very effective on. So you're right. Right now, there's a lot of people who are participating in street protests, demonstrations, carrying signs. That's one thing. And I don't mean to belittle that. I mean, there's a lot of energy right now. There's certainly a lot of energy, especially since November, no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, there's a lot of energy right now. But what's something that you did in Philadelphia, you and your colleagues did in Philadelphia, for example, that went beyond just a street protest? What were some of the things that were actually effective in helping you win when you were going to be outspent big time?
So at one point, we were able to get convince our city council very reluctantly to put a ballot question on whether or not people would have casinos in their neighborhoods or not. And the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, in a very unusual move, many people called it corrupt, stripped the whole thing off the ballot, said you can't vote on it. Democracy isn't the thing that we're going for when it comes to casinos in our backyard. And we could have gone into the street, just done a march, and that would have been fine. As you say, I'm all about people staying in motion. And we thought, what's a way to demonstrate the injustice here? The story isn't sufficient for us to just say it's a bad thing. We want to actually show it. So what we did was we set up our own election system, what we called Philly's Ballot Box, where we set up, we had cardboard boxes that were, we called them our 4-foot-tall receptacles of liberty, where people could vote on the question that the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania refused to allow us to vote on. So on election day, at ballots across the city, we set up these ballot boxes where people could actually vote. And we set it up as a real election. It wasn't just a fake thing. We had election monitors, and we had a system so it was structured, so it was set up with the voting registration system. And what it did was it did far more than just demonstrate our position that it was a bad thing. It was illuminating, and it gave people a chance to see for themselves. They got to have their own opinion. And people who wanted casinos could vote for it. We love people to have debate. But what for us was an example of we are going to institute and demonstrate the democratic social contract. And so in this era when many of us feel the social contract is increasingly eliminated. The goal of activists is to uphold it. And so our goal is actually not just to decry the thing that was bad, but to show the way for what a democratic system would look like, which in our case was giving people the opportunity to have their say, have a democratic vote.
Talking to Daniel Hunter, who is the author of Building a Movement to End the New Jim Crow. He's coming to Rochester next Wednesday night at 7 p.m. for a lecture titled Building Social Movements in a Time of Polarization. He is part of the 2017 Spring Lecture Series and Reunion for Colgate Rochester Crozer Divinity School. And he's our guest for the first half hour here. So that the organizing guide that he wrote defines different roles. And I think people who pick it up and are really interested in effective organization will appreciate this. Because Daniel defines four different roles: helpers, advocates, organizers, and rebels. And to the best you can you kind of define those roles and also explain how people can figure out which role might suit them best, Daniel?
Sure. So, any kind of system of this sort, of course, isn't inclusive of everybody, but what I'm trying to think about is how do we honor there are different strategies and different ways of going at social change. So one strategy is the thing I just shared was an example of organizing, where what we did was we went out and recruited names and contact information and so forth of people who were involved and wanted to do something. And the goal of the organizer is who is being oppressed here and how can we mobilize them so they can advocate for themselves against some injustice. And the goal of a rebel is different. So rebels see an injustice, and they're often the first ones out in the street or the first one in your face. Their goal is to immediately express passionately, directly, often fiercely and vehemently, what's wrong here. So rebels are often the most iconic kind of activist and can get a bad rap for it. But activists who are rebels doing the most effective kind of rebel action, what they're doing is they're showing new values. And so they, whether we like them or don't like them, what they're good at is showing a new way. So they're all about expression. And so they often are first out in terms of an issue. But then there are other kinds of activists that often get far less attention. I think rebels get the most, organized men get a little bit less. But then advocates, for example, are the people who are doing the inside the system advocacy. So lawyers, social workers, people who see that there are institutions that we have, and they may not be everything that we want them to be, and in fact, they're quite deficient. But the role of advocates can be, how do we leverage those systems to make them useful? And then the last would be helpers. And so helpers are people who are often drawn by immediate need. So a helper sees someone in trouble and wants to immediately give medical assistance or physical or give them supplies, or for people who are returning from being in prison, maybe they want to help them get housing or various kinds of things. So helpers are often giving immediate. And the issue for helpers and advocates is that work alone doesn't create social change. It doesn't create a structural change. So if I'm just giving charity, like helpers often do, if I'm only giving charity, it doesn't add up. The system itself isn't challenged. So the role of helpers and advocates is how do we identify how we can also participate in structural changes as well as just the individual. But those are the four roles, and how they intersect and so forth is a whole fascinating area unto itself.
Sure. And
I think the primary goal is, yes, honoring the different strategies that people have.
And I'm thinking about, you're right, rebels get more attention and are more in the face and more in the spotlight. I think you also write, don't you, that rebels are more willing to lose something or might have a little bit more of an opportunity to, I don't say opportunity, but might be able to lose something. They might be arrested. They could lose a job, but they are willing to be there sort of on the front line. And every movement needs people in that position. People who are helpers or advocates might not feel that they can sacrifice as much right now, but do you see people eventually moving from helpers, advocates, to becoming something like, in the paradigm you have, a rebel?
No, I don't think of it so much as it's about becoming a different style, but I think it's about finding the sacrifice that is available to you in your role. So helpers can also be quite sacrificial, or advocates can also be quite sacrificial. So, I mean, just thinking about, for example, advocates who have been involved in intelligence leaking of critical information that we wouldn't have otherwise. Or right now, on the political scene, the EPA, for example, people who are in the EPA under threat around climate change, they have a whole opportunity right now to take risks, to speak out, to tell the truth about what they know the science to be. And I think it actually limits us, the way that we can see rebels and say, that's the way to go, get arrested. And do I want people to be willing to risk arrest? Sure. Do I want people to take risks? Absolutely. That is a requirement for a social movement. That is part of what it takes. And it doesn't take the same kind of sacrifice in all cases.
Dr. McMichael, when you think about what we've been seeing in movements toward equality, I think Daniel's organizing guide makes me think about the fact that some people do feel like, well, I can give money to causes. I can give money to charity. And then you sort of feel like, well, I've done my thing.
Yeah.
Others may say, I can't be one of the people in the streets, or I can't risk this. Or I think about Seneca Lake and the movement against LPG storage and, a big corporation out of state that wants to expand that, and a lot of the environmental movement. And some people saying, I'm willing to stand in front of that entryway and be arrested. Others saying, I can't risk that. Mm-hmm. But what Daniel's work says to me is, just marching in the street once a year and mm-hmm. just giving to charity, those are things that may get attention and may do some things, but they ultimately aren't enough for social change. What do you think?
Yeah, it'll make you feel good for a day. It may or may not get the attention of your opposition, because I think they've learned over time that you're going to only come here once.
They expect you to go away eventually.
There's no persistence to it. The surprise is when you don't go away and you come back and you come back and you come back. I think his category about needing a rebel, somebody who is aggressive, somebody who is outspoken. So let's take, he references James Lawson and Martin King. So in many respects, James Lawson was more of an organizer. He was the person teaching nonviolence. He was getting people ready to go out into the street, but he himself was not among those regularly doing so. Martin King, Ralph Abernathy, Wyatt Walker, and others, those were the rebels. But you couldn't have the one without the other in the civil rights movement. So you have to have that vanguard of people who are aggressive and are unchained in terms of the consequences. The truth is, there aren't that many of them. And so you can find a lot of helpers. Finding somebody who's really willing to risk the loss of something, very different matter.
But here's I think this will offer some hope for people involved in various movements. Daniel also writes about myths about movements, and one of them is that movements are always built by heroic figurehead leaders. Daniel, can you address that?
Sure. So, you talked about how rebels, for example, are misconstrued, and it's the case that activists are often misconstrued. And one of the ways that we are mistaught history is that movements are built up by, as you say, heroic leaders or people who are particularly charismatic or persuasive, and that movements often have them, that they often are around. But as Dr. McMichael said, organizers set the stage. They gather lots of people, and those people aren't all charismatic leaders. Actually, most of the bulk of the work of the civil rights movement, for example, was regular folk who may not have been a Dr. King or may not have had that charisma. And in fact, in most cases, I think if you look at the history, movements are built up from regular people, and they might lift out some particular leaders that come out of the movement. But when movements start, when the Montgomery bus boycott got started, Dr. King wasn't on the scene on those first early nights. And that, again, over and over again in history, you see that. So one way we're taught not to, it's almost like we're taught not to participate in movements because we're looking for someone else to follow or someone else to do the thing on. But actually, movements are available to us. the way that we build a movement, and I'll just go back to the theme of campaigns, the way that we begin building a movement is campaigns, which is ongoing pressure over time as opposed to a one-off action, but is instead how do we do sustained actions one after another that escalate by getting new people and an increased amount of pressure. So it doesn't matter if we start with 1,000 people or 5. Start with your 5 and then make 6 and then make 7. But the goal of a campaign is to keep coming back, as Dr. McMichael said.
And to have a measurable, attainable goal. I think the most important thing Daniel has said is there was a specific thing they were trying to achieve, and you can organize around that specific thing. So many of our more recent movements have been about things that you can't quite put your finger on. You know, what are we trying to accomplish here? So I think it's important that they had a very measurable objective.
And one more question for Daniel before we let him go here. And again, we should tell you that all the lectures, I think, are free and open to the public next week. So Monday through Thursday at Colgate Crozer Rochester Divinity School, all of these spring lectures are free and open to the public. And Daniel will be here at 7 p.m. on Wednesday night, but we'll make sure we'll link to the full schedule in various places for you. Daniel, you write in your organizing guide, quote, "Those who most benefit from the current prison system will defend it. We therefore need to learn to wage struggle for a new society unwilling to allow any human life to be thought of as expendable, that doesn't mask problems by throwing people behind bars," end quote. So more than just, again, a march in the street once a year, what is the kind of struggle that you might envision that could be effective to change a system that is unequal in this kind of way?
Well, I think this theme is important. So of identifying a campaign which is looking at targets, and by that we mean who is it who can give you a chunk of what you want? And I think that when we're developing a campaign, it's important that we look at, I talk about this more in the book, but I talk about how it's important that we develop clear goals that can rally other people to this, and that we can begin waging, this is a conflict, and we're waging conflict here. And so what we're doing is we're engaging in, we want this thing, and then there will be a reaction. There will be a backlash from those who have either financial or other kinds of interest in the system as it currently is. And I think, going back to the theme of polarization, in a time of polarization, I think we have to embrace the part of us that can handle conflict. And that is one of the things that we're going to have to do in order to make it through this period of time, which is we have to get better at waging struggle. And I think the waging struggle involves identifying goals, identifying targets, and then being willing to put pressure over time to make that happen. And I think the transformational part of that comes when we speak clearly from our passion, our heart, our values, and so that resonates for others to also see.
The subject of the Colgate Spring Lecture Series next week is When I Was in Prison, Restoring Dignity and Justice. And Daniel Hunter will be here on Wednesday night presenting Building Social Movements in a Time of Polarization. You can find his organizing guide there that night. All of these lectures are free and open to the public. Daniel, we'll see you next week. Thanks for taking the time for the program today.
Thank you so much, Evan.
And we are due for our only break of the hour. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Maurice Tomlinson, who's an attorney and LGBTQI human rights advocate and a senior policy analyst with the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network. His work has been remarkable, not just right here near us, but around the world and looking at what's happening in the Caribbean. When you hear about the laws and the possible penalties for, well, we'll talk about it. We'll talk about what Maurice has been working on and, in his view, what might be changing there. We'll also talk about with Dr. McMichael about what else you can expect next week. You can find that full spring lecture series online at crcds.edu, and we'll make sure we link to it as well. It's all coming up next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking about deaf culture. We're talking about what the hearing community should know to make sure that they are being respectful of the deaf community, making sure inclusion is possible, that opportunities are real and not denied. We'll ask some basic questions. What's the difference between deaf with a capital D and deaf with a lowercase d? Cultural questions and more. It's next hour. In our very svelte break, I was just saying to Dr. McMickle that, you know, it will be interesting to see if what he talked about with Daniel Hunter in our last half hour will bear some fruit here, whether these new movements we've seen, more people getting involved. You know, the Women's March is an example in January of something that didn't have a whole lot of singularly defined goals, but that won't matter if those millions of people around the world then kind of branch off and create their singular goals and stay involved in a movement, as opposed to saying, when's the next march a year from now?
Right.
And you were saying that the history of suffrage movements, other movements, you were watching on WXXI last night?
Watching it last night. There's a special on what's called the Great War, World War I. But as a subtext of that, there was a description of a group of women who went to stand out in front of the White House holding up banners about women's rights to vote, regularly ignored by Woodrow Wilson. They kept coming, and they finally put them in prison for, you know, loitering and public nuisance and such. They went on a hunger strike in prison, about 40 of them. They kept the pressure up for over a year. One day, Wilson sends someone to them in prison. They're released the next day, and about a week later, Wilson announces his support for women's right to vote. So their persistence resulted in the passage of the amendment to the Constitution, or his approval of the amendment, but they just stayed at it for over a year.
People from all different political backgrounds since November, again, this isn't a political comment, it's just an observation, have said they're more engaged in their community and more engaged in potential movements and causes than ever before. A lot of people have said that. Do you think this is different? Will it be sustained?
Well, I think there are reasons for it to be different because there's so much at stake. Environmentalists have a reason to remain engaged. Persons who are concerned about police reform, given Jeff Sessions' recent statements, have a reason to stay engaged. The question is whether or not life will catch up with them and they'll find themselves being pulled back into their ordinary cycle. But I believe some folks always have remained engaged and always will remain engaged, and those are the organizers, and those are the rebels.
We're going to talk to Maurice Tomlinson in a moment, but there's a bunch of other events, and Dr. McMichael, I'll sort of just open the floor to you, and why don't you tell us what else that, and we talked to Daniel Hunter, we're going to talk to Maurice Tomlinson, but there's other things on the schedule next week. What would you want our listeners to know?
Well, I certainly would urge them, if they aren't coming to us to see it, to see the film entitled 13th, which is a story, it's almost a movie version of Michelle Alexander's book about the history of the criminal justice system and the various ways, even laws, by which African-American incarceration was driven in order to control a part of the population. So the 13th is partly the 13th Amendment that was supposed to end slavery, but it is also the continuation of a slave regime using the criminal justice system and incarceration to that end. So I really think it's a film worth seeing. We've got a seating capacity of about 120. 80 have already signed up.
And where is all this happening, by the way?
On the campus in a lecture hall on the ground floor of Strong Hall. So we may have to get this film and show it again. It's a Netflix film, so we cannot take it to a theater that has a bigger seating capacity because it's not our film.
Dr. McMichael, I've talked to people, I will not reveal their names, but pretty prominent people in this community. I'm thinking of two people in general, white people, who said they watched this film and they feel pretty tuned into issues and events, and they cried. And they said, this has changed me, that film.
Yeah. It is a gruesome story. I think about, for instance, convict lease system, which was you would arrest somebody for vagrancy because they were put off of a plantation. Now you've got them incarcerated, and then you send them out, leased to the county or leased to the state government, to essentially resume the role of slave labor. And, of course, you never give them the right to vote, or if they had it, it's taken away. It is a sad chapter of American history, which I think has intentionally been kept from public view. And this film And Alexander's book, I think, really pulled the cover back on a really sad chapter.
All right, so you're showing the 13th. What else is coming up that you want people to know about?
Well, there's a series of one of the things I'm really excited about is Edward Hunt is coming from New York City to talk about an actual academic program training persons for ministry inside of Sing Sing Prison. I was the first group of faculty persons to teach inside of Sing Sing in 1985. It's really called the Ossining Correctional Center in Ossining, New York. One of the most chilling moments of my life was the first time an iron gate slammed behind me, and I was literally between two sets of bars and then into the prison. He's been running that program for a long time. How do you take theological education out of a seminary into a prison system and train long-term prisoners to become prison chaplain assistants? So he's coming on Tuesday and preaching on Wednesday. Daniel is on Wednesday evening, and then your next guest is coming in on Thursday. So it's going to be fascinating. A panel discussion on Thursday morning. One of our doctoral graduates is a part of this panel. So everything is about the way in which the criminal justice system and incarceration touch our lives in so many ways. Prison reform, prison sentencing, what happens if you are three strikes and you're out in some states. So we want folks to really get an earful about what's happening, usually without their knowledge, in our criminal justice system.
Well, our next guest on the phone with us is Maurice Tomlinson, who's an attorney, an LGBT human rights advocate, and a senior policy analyst with the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network. And Maurice is coming to give a lecture titled When Faith Kills, a report from the LGBTQI Jamaican Frontlines. Maurice, thanks for joining the program. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. I'm going back trying to... I spent some time last evening not only digging in through the interviews you've given on various subjects, but also the history of LGBT law and sodomy law that, if I'm being honest, Maurice, I mean, I was reading a Huffington Post story from 2013 that looked to me like it was from the 1950s, but it wasn't. So let me just read a little bit from what I was reading on HuffPo and from a 2013 story, and then, Maurice, maybe you can kind of update us where things stand now and the work that you're doing. This is what Huffington Post wrote. Quote, the repeal of Jamaica's long outdated sodomy law, a relic of British imperialism that defines homosexual acts as the abominable crime of buggery and sets a maximum of 10 years of hard labor as punishment, is going to be debated during an upcoming parliamentary session. And it says, while the 1864 law itself is rarely enforced, it is widely viewed in Jamaica to be the linchpin of a national ideology that embraces homophobia and violently rejects the idea of gay rights at all. A 2013 survey found that 82% of Jamaicans consider homosexuality morally wrong, 85% do not think it should be made legal. And the article goes on then to quote a number of people. First of all, former Prime Minister Bruce Golding, who had said he would never want gay people in his cabinet. The Reverend Al Miller, who was a leading religious voice, who was talking about deporting the LGBTQ community and saying that it was an international movement to make the religious community accept values that they don't have to accept. And then the article talks about Maurice Tomlinson, who was leading this effort after dramatically returning to Jamaica to argue a case before the Supreme Court that charged the three main Jamaican television broadcasters with violating Jamaica's new Charter for Fundamental Human Rights and Freedoms. Apparently, they didn't want to put some TV spots depicting straight Jamaicans showing support for gay friends and relatives, saying that violated their standards. I mean, all of this sounds decades and decades old, but I know this is just the last few years. Can you take us through some of that, Maurice?
Yes, but before I begin, I wanted to make almost a caveat statement that a lot of the discussions around the anti-sodomy law in Jamaica are creating almost this image of a backward, regressive society. The sad reality is that this is an imposition. This situation we're in is an imposition of global North religion, cultural practices, attitudes, and laws, which we have sadly now started to replicate. And I make this point because I think it's important for your listeners to understand that the U.S., Canada, the global North countries have a role to play in pushing back against this, because our cultures were not instinctively homophobic. We were taught to hate. this is stuff that has been coming, washing up on our shores from places like the U.S. after the culture war was lost in the United States. And so I'll give some examples later on of how religious groups from the United States have pushed this homophobia and whipped up this homophobia to the point now where we are seeing what you described as 1950s regressive attitudes in Jamaica that you have long since chucked, because the people who held those views in North America are now exporting it to Jamaica. So my point is, this is not about Jamaica bashing. This is about Jamaica realizing.
Sure.
Jamaica has a strong history of human rights advocacy. We were the first country to impose sanctions against apartheid South Africa. We were the first country to sign the UN Declaration of the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. But we have this blind spot on LGBT rights because of what we have imported from the global north. Now, that said, in 2012, the anti-sodomy law in Jamaica, which you described, which imposes up to 10 years in prison at hard labor for any form of male same-gender intimacy, including two men holding hands in the privacy of their bedroom, the law was updated in 2012. So now you must be registered as a sex offender when you're released, and you must carry a pass at all times, or you will face a $1 million fine plus 12 months in prison at hard labor. And that's just since 2012. The survey that you mentioned that said that the number of the level of homophobia was about 81%. Mm-hmm. In 2015, we redid the survey, and the level of homophobia is now at 91%. And I am challenging the law, and the court has allowed 10 religious groups, most with American support, evangelical groups, to be admitted as interested parties to defend the law. And they claim that the law is necessary to prevent the extinction of mankind and to protect their religious freedom. But the same court disallowed and banned the public defender to join the case to support me. So literally, it's 10 plus the government, so it's 11 against 1, and the court will not allow the public defender to even try and, you know, support a repeal of the law. And that's just the anti-sodomy law. My case challenging the TV stations is now before the Court of Appeal, and the TV stations again have the support of the religious groups, which are very, very powerful. And I try to explain to people that the situation in Jamaica is not too hard if you put yourself in the perspective of living in a small town in North America. Think of the most rural town in North America. Then surrounded by a moat, and then fill it with sharks. Conservative attitudes are reinforced in this context, and it's hard for new ideas and progressive values to enter, especially when the main social, you know, agent is the church, because they provide financial support and services that the government can't. And the church is heavily, heavily influenced by evangelical right-wing thinking, much of it coming from the United States. And this is why we are in the situation we're in. It's not that the politicians don't think the law must go. They all think so. But the fact is, the church has a responsibility for these laws and for getting rid of these laws.
All right, so I want to ask Dr. McMichael to weigh in on a theme we just heard from Maurice Tomlinson. And then I want to ask Maurice what the next steps are to effecting change. Too often we have this conversation about LGBTQ rights as if it's, you know, well, our country, we have equal marriage, so, you know, it's sort of over. First of all, it's not over. And second of all, you look around the world and you see prison sentences, 10 years hard labor for two men holding hands, 12 months in prison for two men holding hands. It's just remarkable. But Dr. McMichael, former Prime Minister of Jamaica Bruce Golding, said this, quote, "We are predominantly a Christian country. We are a fervently Christian country. We are passionately committed to certain Christian principles which issue homosexuality," end quote. And the Reverend Al Miller said that a group of concerned pastors and leaders were mobilizing and would resist any attempts to tamper with Jamaica's constitution as it relates to anti-LGBT law. He says it would be foisting on our nation in any shape or form the gay rights agenda, which is alien to our culture as a people, end quote. When they make those statements, they're making this blanket commentary that that's what it means to be Christian. And I know, I think you strongly disagree that you should make this blanket description that if you're Christian, it means you're anti-gay.
What they're probably doing is taking four, maybe five verses, carefully selected and unusually interpreted to pick the sin of their preference. Let's take Romans 1, which is one of those verses that they probably are using down there, and ask if they are fervently Christian and deeply committed, then after a single reference to men and women having relations with one another, men and men, women and women, it goes on to deal with malice, to deal with greed, to deal with anger, to deal with jealousy. So my question always is, how is it that you can take out of a list of 10 things that are in the same verse and can simply identify the one thing that you want to come down on, but either ignore or explain away everything else?
Where's the anti-jealousy law?
Yeah.
The 10-year sentence for jealousy.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. In Leviticus, Leviticus 18:22 is one of their favorite verses, but they somehow overlooked the fact that in Levitical law, you also should not eat shrimp. I wonder how many folk in Jamaica eat shellfish. You cannot in Jamaica enjoy shellfish and bash persons who are homosexual from the same Bible. So the level of hypocrisy that is used to justify the church coming out against people on the basis of one behavior, which, by the way, Jesus never once referenced. I just take great irony in the fact that the Christ at the center of the Christian never said a word about gay and sexual activity, but spoke a lot about the poor, the homeless, the widow, the orphan, the stranger. How do we manage to ignore everything he did say and focus on the one thing which nobody can find a text in which he ever referenced it one time?
Well, Maurice Tomlinson, what do you do next now, not just to win in court? I mean, I think when people write about your work, everywhere I went last night to read about you, people talked about you in almost heroic terms. And every interview I saw, you're always smiling despite the very difficult challenge of your job. I admire that about you. But it's one thing to try to win in court. It's another, as you say, to be, you know, going back to a place where, you know, homophobia is not inherent, but is taught. And now it's taught very, very effectively. And you've got 90%+, you know, talking about homosexuality being morally wrong. What do you think could effectively reverse some of those numbers, Maurice?
Yes, and that's the work that I'm excited about and why I smile. Because I refuse to accept the victim narrative. I think just as how my people have a history of human rights leadership, we can be taught to respect the rights of LGBT people, and we are doing that work. So some of the things we're doing include working with progressive religious leaders. There are some really supportive LGBT endorsing or affirming religious leaders in Jamaica and across the Caribbean, and it's getting their voices amplified. So there's Father Sean Major Campbell, an Anglican priest who washed the feet of lesbians on World Human Rights Day 2014 in his church. And it caused quite a backlash for him. But he, instead of retreating, he doubled down, has become more vocal. And since then, we're collaborating on putting together the first ever conference in Jamaica with religious leaders talking about the church and homosexuality. And having these hard conversations with religious leaders is incredibly important because, yes, we may change the law. We may even get progressive ads on TV. We may, you know, be able to get in schools inclusive language, et cetera, et cetera. But at the core of the Jamaican identity is our faith, one form or the other. Every Jamaican has to go to church. It's not an option. You know, you don't have the default of atheist, no. And most of our schools are also religious. So we are doing a lot of work with religious leaders, and we'll be holding that conference at the end of this year. We're also getting progressive leaders to make statements through op-eds. And in other words, we're trying to change the discourse. The other thing that my organization, the Canadian HIV AIDS Legal Network, is doing, in addition to the legal challenges, we're doing police LGBT sensitivity training, because we know that visibility is liberty. If people see gay people and get to know them and realize that these stereotypes of freaks, etc., that they hear from their normally the pulpit, are wrong, it's just fabrication, then it'll be easier. People fear what they don't know. And so we want to provide security for persons to be out so that when they're attacked, they will know that the police will respond. And if the community knows that the police will respond, they'll be less inclined to attack LGBT people. So we're doing this sensitivity training because first you have to get the police to see LGBT people as humans, which sadly they don't. We are considered an abomination because that's what PASA tells them. You know, we're also working with the diaspora groups because we know that diaspora groups have a lot of power. They can send back not only their resources in terms of financial resources, but they have dialogue with their family and friends and can say, look, you know, all of this you're hearing, I live in a society where that is inclusive. And none of this is materializing. The world hasn't come to an end because we have marriage equality in the United States. So we're getting the diaspora groups to use their power and their influence. And we're also trying to do backdoor negotiations with some of the politicians. But, you know, that's the politicians are always very polite. But we know at the end of the day, they are looking for the critical mass of support for decrim and for LGBT human rights before they'll make any move. And so that's why we're concentrating on working with the groups that are most intransient, and that right now for us is the religious fundamentalists.
Maurice Tomlinson will be here next Thursday night at 7 p.m. for a lecture titled When Faith Kills, a report from the LGBTQI Jamaican Front Lines. You've heard a bit of a preview on that now. All of the lectures are free and open to the public for the Colgate, Rochester, Crozier Divinity Schools Spring Lecture Series next week. And Maurice, thank you for taking the time. We will see you here next Thursday.
My pleasure.
That's Maurice Tomlinson joining us. I want to squeeze in against my better judgment one quick phone call because Jim in Rochester has been waiting. But Jim, you got to keep it tight. Go ahead, sir. Are you there, Jim? I lost Jim. No. Oh, I lost them both now. Well, yep, that was my fault. Well, Jim, I gave it a good shot there. And but you know what? You should probably go out next week because there's a series of events. You can find Dr. McMickle at Colgate. He's very accessible. You know, so Dr. McMickle, as we get ready to wrap up here, why don't you give us some final thoughts on the theme for this series again, which is When I Was in Prison, Restoring Dignity and Justice. You just heard Maurice. You heard Daniel Hunter. You've got a lot coming up next week.
I think that one of the roles of a theological school is to take the core teachings of our faith and make them available and accessible to the broader public. So even if you're not enrolled as a student, there are occasions when everything that the faith represents as we understand it is brought right to you with speakers and lectures and films. This is a chance for persons to tap in to the core message of CRCDS.
All right. Well, that is all coming up next week here, and we've got a chance for you to see the full schedule of events at Colgate, crcds.edu/spring-lecture-week, and it's a piece of cake. It's easy to get there. I think register would be great because some of these events may actually fill up, as you said, the 13th.
Yeah, the film is going to be something, so they should try to call ahead for that.
Okay, and it's always good to talk to you. You know, I know you said you know, you want the broader community to be aware of this, not just people on campus, people who are there at Colgate. There are a number of listeners every time you're on. Well, you light people up. I've got some people who say, Dr. McMickle is my favorite Connections guest. I've got some who say, I want to give him a piece of my mind. You know, there's always...
Well, I get those
all. Yeah, you know, there's always the passionate reaction on all sides here. But it's always great to have you. So I hope you have a great week next week.
Thank you. We're looking forward to it. Appreciate the time.
And thank you for facilitating the conversation with both Daniel Hunter and Maurice Tomlinson, who joined us this hour. Thanks for listening here. That's Dr. Marvin McMickle talking about their spring lecture series. We have a big next hour doing some things that we have not done on this program, and we'll tell you all about it in about 90 seconds. So hope you stay with us right here on Connections.